Welcome to a bonus episode of the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Chagnon. As we mentioned at the end of the last episode, we enjoyed the talk with Alexander Dunlap so much that we just completely lost track of time. So, we decided to split off the conversation about Fossil Fuel Plus and have a bonus episode devoted entirely to the conceptualization of the world eater, total extractivism, and major systemic issues impacting our lives and our planet, with a healthy dose of criticism of the academic system as well. So, welcome back for the bonus episode. We hope you enjoy. Your work has influenced my work and some work that Sophia and I have done together in this idea of the world eater and total extraction, because, you know, we're looking a lot at data extraction. And then, of course, because that's like going more into like treated very much as a resource, but it's like your movements, your idea, your very being the resource that's being extracted, but then being connected through all these ways of energy, resources, stuff like that to all the other forms. And that's why we really latched onto this idea so much, because it puts it together so beautifully, connecting like the extraction of ourselves to the extraction of the world. But since we can have it straight from the horse's mouth, would you mind telling our listeners a bit about the world eater, about this total extraction idea?
Yeah. I mean, maybe this comes to kind of the earlier in the talk of, you know, how do you relate to industrial infrastructure? How do you relate to technological infrastructures when you walk out the door? And I mean, how do you look when you're in a city and you're just surrounded by asphalt, concrete, and steel and wires and things like this? It kind of raises questions of like, what's really happening to the world? Like, this isn't just development. I mean, maybe we can call it that, but it's, you know, what is this? How can we even discuss what is happening to ecosystems and land base? Like, this is, and then to call it green or sustainable is literally psychotic and delusional. And granted, these are big problems too. So it's not to necessarily point fingers if you're trying to make social change or things like this, but it's to say like, hey, this is serious. We need to really think differently about how we speak about this and how we conceptualize these problems. Because the old goal washing of sustainable development goals and the way that the circus has been running since I've ever been alive is insane. And so my reaction to this is, so I did a book with Jostein Jakobsen about talking about this idea of total extractivism, and it's a bit negative. And it's not to say that there aren't lines of flight, and there's most certainly people resisting, and there's a lot of ways out. There's always cracks and fissures to kind of resist these things and to make spaces of happiness and to stop these things, really. But really, we have to identify that there's a trend in place, there's a trajectory, there's an ideology of progress and technological development that is really geared towards extracting and consuming the entire world, and then also having its sights set on the moon and Mars and other places to take more resources. So this is really about, you know, eating an entire world and then moving on to eating others is this even for humans? You know, like, obviously it is said that it is, but how well is it actually doing us? How happy are people in their daily lives? I knew, like, living in different boxes, living in unhealthy work routines. I'm speaking from a perspective of like the nice way. I'm not talking about, then we think about living in the plantations, the mines, the iPod factories, the different sweatshops and things like this. I mean, it is crazy what's being done to this world. And for me, that we're dealing with a situation, as much as there's a class element in it, it's also a social war, in the sense where you're seeing even affluent, wealthy, extremely rich people with so many opportunities, they're not happy. And I think a long time ago, they're still kind of hooked on different kind of, they're still addicted to work. They're consumed with these things. There's a high level of unhappiness. If you look, I read a statistic, there was some statistic, I'm not sure how good it was, but it was saying that kind of rich and poor people were trying to kill themselves at roughly the same rate. It was out of some Cambridge journal, but they were trying to kill themselves at roughly the same rate. But the big difference was that the rich had access to hospitals and they could get their stomachs pumped and things like this. Where in India, for example, they were just drinking pesticides and fertilizers and no more. So for me, I see that it's pretty crazy what's going on. And there's a lot of possibilities to live happier, healthier lives and to live in touch with our ecosystems and develop different relationships with animals. But overall, be happy and not be stuck to certain work routines that are either somewhere between drudgery and addiction, if you've got on the nicer side of things, you know, and I would describe the academic one more on the side of addiction. But so this means, how do we talk about this? Like, what's really going on? Like, why are humans letting the world go this way? Why, like, can we stop poisoning things? Can we start living well, like, can we start living with our environments? Can we start increasing the qualities of water, increasing the qualities of food and soil? Like, why isn't this the trend, the popular thing that is being forced across the board? Because obviously there's tons of forest gardeners and permaculturists and indigenous people across the world who have been and are doing this still. But why is the mainstream industrial society, and this is north and south of the globe, why is it being total destruction? And so the idea of this was to draw on Freddie Perlman, who's someone lesser known in academia and more outside it, who wrote a very interesting book called Against His Story, Against Leviathan, which was a very interesting, it was very poetic, some historical inaccuracies, but it was his story of the birth of civilization to the 1980s. And just start, stop, there wasn't much kind of academic structure, but it just went. And in this, there's a deep understanding and poetics of actually how people are consumed and possessed to actually work against their interests, to actually degrade their environments, to fight each other in certain ways. And he talked about state formation in mythological terms, in terms of talking about giant mechanical worms and octopus, to talk about different states or different kind of overseas travels and things like this. And he talks about the complicated processes of how they fight, die, form, decompose, but how in the end, with the rise of kind of industrialization, how they form and come together to create one big monster of the world eater. And he probably references the term like 3 or 6 times in the entire book. And for me, this is interesting, this idea of taking a more mythological approach to understanding what is actually happening. And this links with Michael Tossing's Devil and Commodity Fetishism, how different indigenous groups in Bolivia and Colombia would refer to mines and plantations as kind of devils in terms of evil spirits that were kind of consuming and possessing things. So it's, and also, you know, with the Zapatistas talking about the many-headed hydra. So I think this turn towards looking at mythology to understand the current circumstance of why humans are ultimately being possessed or believing in a certain kind of reified or kind of different, they're believing in an idea, they're empowering these ideas of development that are ultimately destroying the world or consuming it. And it's on this trajectory. And it's not to say that it's final, but it's to say that, hey, this is the train that we're on. I think everyone's well aware of this train at this point, considering when we're talking about the sixth extinction and widespread ecological and climate catastrophe. But to say, hey, this has to stop. We really have to begin engaging in serious post-development strategies, serious kind of decolonial degrowth strategies to stop this on the mainstream. And it has to go viral. And there has to be a real change in kind of cultural value systems and how we relate to the land, but also each other and the animals around us.
Do you think part of the inability, or what seems like an inability, of people to really get on board with making these big, deep changes is some of the like almost info glut that we have created with like the infrastructure of the modern world? Is just, there's so many inputs all the time. Like, how are we supposed to focus under that? You know, like what's the crisis that we should deal with first? You know, where do we start? I know that sometimes for me that almost, when there's so much input and incoming and this is terrible and this is wrong and there's a sliver of hope here, but it all kind of feels dark, that one of the things that I do, and I'm not necessarily proud of this, but that makes me personally sometimes tend to want to retreat. Do you think that is part of what kind of this loggerheads is?
Yeah, evasion, dropping out. I mean, at this point, I think all tools and styles of stopping this thing are still on the table, you know? But I mean, it kind of brings up the term that I think I'm most kind of interested in, or I think is important, and that's the idea of infrastructural colonization, and which kind of really tries to draw continuity between colonial eras and ideologies through infrastructure, and to say that, you know, we're colonized by infrastructure. And this is also to remember that the first cultures to be colonized had to colonize themselves first. And that is to really point at kind of state formation. Well, ancient civilizations kind of in line with Freddie Perlman, but really that state formations had to domesticate, colonize, and subordinate their populations to even become a colonial power in the first place, to begin going overseas and kind of grabbing natural resources. And so this idea of infrastructural colonization, I think, is really important for us to think about actually how we're colonized by infrastructure and how infrastructure, you know, how much is it really working for us, or and how much is it really kind of our cages and kind of holding us in there. And a lot of this, and it's not just coercion that it operates through enchantment, it operates through allure, it operates through convenience, you know, and it operates through making our immediate day-to-day lives easier. You know, a lot of the way that techno addiction takes place is just through workplaces, kind of making us being able to make things easier. And it's fun, it's interesting, and even if it's not good for us, you know. But so I think this idea of infrastructural colonization is really important in terms of assessing our own lives and actually looking at what's going on around us, and to ask the question of like, what is the colony? What is real decolonization? Can you even decolonize the university in a real way of like, what's the material? I think the discursive practice and kind of, and racisms and different things like this are well established, even if they're still very prevalent. But it's, you know, what is this in the here and now? What are the immediate material structures holding these things into place? And I think asking this is important because, yeah, I don't think the academic lifestyle is particularly healthy. I don't think it's necessarily bringing the kind of the social change that I'd like to see in this world. And if anything, it's kind of reinforcing certain value structures, certain infrastructures that I think are very toxic to not only people's kind of mentalities and lives, but also are embedded in energy intensive infrastructures that are doing a number on the environments that they're in, and some worse than others. But I think there's a lack of reflection to really look at ourselves in our own context and our offices and the computers and the lights that we use and where these things come from and how it works, and to be extremely uncritical about these things. And I would like to see this become more of a spread within departments to really ask themselves and to reflect what these are. But again, this comes down to political kind of issues. You know, I'm coming from a perspective where I don't necessarily have the same attachment to these infrastructures or these technologies or this kind of culture. You know, a lot of people might have fought their whole lives to have a certain level of integration or have a liberal politics that guides them a certain way, or they think that, yeah, I don't necessarily, yeah, it's a difficult one because it's really about defining, you know, where the problems emanate and where they are and how they act out in your day-to-day life. And for me, that's easy in terms of looking at extractive supply chains and how they work and what type of relationships existing infrastructures create. But then this is going to be different for different people in terms of, you know, how much engagement do you want with kind of infrastructure and certain technologies, and then how to actually make them healthy. And this goes back to old conversations between convivial technologies and industrial cybernetic technologies, and where are humans able to live with their environments and care for animals and to be within their habitats, but still have certain conveniences and things like this, and how to create this balance. But then again, we live in a society that's not even the conversation. It's more and more and more, take more. This is green, keep going, you know? But yeah, I feel like maybe I didn't answer that because it's maybe a bit more of a question about resistance, but I struggle personally with my life tied up with computers and playing academic and traveling in certain ways where it's not particularly healthy for my life. And I don't think it's actually, the academic system isn't necessarily making the social change it ought to. And it's not, departments and universities aren't actually standing up to actually make changes within their departments in a very real way in terms of, you know, for me, I want to see forest gardens as growing our own food and brewing our own beer in our departments, and to really push for larger structural changes within the societies that universities are extremely important and giant kind of profit mechanisms, and kind of and also they're generating the knowledge and they're reinforcing the kind of the same, they're creating the next specialists and technocrats for tomorrow to keep the machine going. And I really hope that across departments and disciplines there becomes more awareness of actually how to identify the problem and to not fetishize technological progress and rampant development and subjugation of ecosystems.
Agreed. That's such a salient point. And if our listeners are interested more in that, we'll link down below to the talk by the Middlebury students that was given at the Exalt Symposium. And then also in January of 2020, one of the actual inaugural events for the Exalt Initiative was looking at how we could repurpose the university to address the climate emergency. So that was one of the questions that we really started with. And hopefully we'll be able to continue to return back to that as we continue on this journey of being an initiative. But yeah, I really appreciate the point because it's true. Like, it does need to start at home. And I think sometimes, once again, I know I just talked about like retreat, but it's like, where does that start, you know, it's so hard within like these infrastructures that are in place and the bureaucracy that already exists. Like for example, the Exalt Symposium had to go digital due to the global situation. Well, under the normal conference apparatus, like speaker gifts, for example, is something that is very common, like within the university. It's an extremely common thing. You have a keynote come and you give them a bottle of wine or a box of chocolates or something, to, you know, a little gesture for their time. Well, with our digital conference, we were really trying to think about ways that we could thank our speakers without, you know, obviously I can't give you a bottle of wine through Zoom. But one of the things that we came up with is we thought like, okay, there's an environmental organization here in Finland that's been doing really good work toward peatland restoration. So we're like, okay, we will, for each of the speakers, we'll donate a certain portion to be able to, you know, buy an amount of peatland restoration, which has its own potential problematic bits, but it's at least a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Completely blocked by the university. They're like, that's not a speaker gift. That's not what a speaker gift looks like. That's, you can't donate to this environmental organization as a speaker gift. Like, whoa. And now literally it's been what? Well, at the time of this recording, it's been a couple of weeks since the conference. So this actually could be resolved by the time it's aired. But I've gone through tens of emails and multiple levels of bureaucracy just to try to get this new imaginary of a very common practice into place. And that's just like one itty bitty little insignificant thing, but it's so hard to fight the machine, even when it's good stuff.
But the little things matter. The little things matter.
Definitely. And, you know, something I really appreciate in all this, something I think the three of us have in common is that before we became academics, quote unquote, we were outside of academia. And I do feel like there's a big difference, though not necessarily that huge of a difference, but there's still like you could see something with people who've gone straight through, which I mean, no offense to my colleagues that have done that, that are doing that. And people who have been outside and are coming back in and are used to a more, I guess, quote unquote, results oriented way of going through the world. Again, nothing against my colleagues. And as well, that's a whole, we can get into a whole other thing of how that's the entire system too, putting that sort of mentality into us for other types of results that help the system. But I feel like this is a very valuable thing to look at, because we can't just look at criticism for the sake of criticism. And I think that this viewpoint of looking at these incredibly diverse shades of gray, that there are so many different things that we need to look at within ourselves, within our societies, to realize that we can't find the perfect way. There is no silver bullet, no matter what a politician tells you or something like that. There's no silver bullet. There's just trying to look and balance things out for yourself and for your community. And this is always one of those things when I look at so many of these things, and especially looking at the polarization of politics, you see people who argue for hydrocarbons and stuff talking about how problematic windmills can be. And it's one of those where it's like, okay, yeah, but are you also like saying that there doesn't need to be any change? But that's not accurate either. Like there are so many things that like people are interested in, but because of the way the system is built and the way our politics and discourses are, it's so much easier to have people pitted against each other than it is to bring people together and actually see how much we have in common.
No, totally. I mean, this just makes me think of the importance of anarchist anti-politics, which is to be different from apolitical. And if anything, with James Ferguson, he did the anti-politics machine to kind of refer to kind of technocratic development, kind of ways to push through development processes and do nasty things. But I think that the idea of anarchist anti-politics is very important in the sense of that recognizing that politics in and of itself is a social control mechanism designed to divide people, to prevent people from acting on their common interests, which, I mean, we depend, everything comes from our ecosystems and comes from each other, you know? So I think it's really important to actually cut, for exactly the reasons that you mentioned, it's really important to cut through these things and to not take the bread and circus thing and to see the problem of these rigid ideologies and the problems of the immense amount of problems of political parties and what they are, and to actually to begin really focusing on what matters and living those things directly in an unmediated way.
I think that it's really interesting that you brought up the bread and circus thing, because I do think that like the focus on entertainment and entertainment being held so highly as like the ideal, oh, as long as I'm entertained, everything is fine. And I mean, it's true. This is a tactic that's been used for, dare I say, millennia. Like, just keep them distracted. If you keep them distracted, then everything else will be okay. And I know that I myself fall prey to that. I mean, absolutely. Like, oh, you know, sometimes it's hard to muster up the energy when we are not trapped, because I'm not trapped necessarily, but you know, we're on the hamster wheel of these lives that we've created for ourselves. And it's like, I have to work. And then when I'm not working, it's easier to just lay on the couch and watch Netflix because it's entertaining. And you know what, to a certain extent, on a moment to moment basis, it does actually feel good. Of course, in the big picture, not so much, but
yeah, I mean, yeah. those are high level speed. Like they're releasing good chemicals in you.
Absolutely. It does. It is. It's true. I mean, I think that it was really interesting. You brought up a few times the concept of addiction, and you know, in academia, like I do see it as an addiction. I mean, if I wasn't, I mean, call it academia, call it technology, call it interpersonal connection through social media, whatever it is that I'm actually addicted to. But if I wasn't addicted, would I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and the first thing I do is grab my phone?
Yeah.
The first thing I do is open my work emails and see what's come in like over the last 3 hours that I've been sleeping potentially, because God forbid I miss anything, a little bit of FOMO going on there. But yeah, I think
it causes stress, but it's also interesting.
Absolutely. So much stress, but so much intrigue at the same time.
Yeah.
So yeah, addiction, I think, is a very, I don't know, maybe good word is hard to say, because, you know, the first thing we know about addiction is our brains will do everything in the world to try to tell us we're not addicted. But yeah, I do definitely resonates really strongly with me in terms of like, an addiction to my work, an addiction to energy, as it will, you know, as it were, addiction to the infrastructure that supports these systems that are actually causing intense ecological damage. Do I have the same addiction to sitting by a stream? Honestly, not really, but I should.
No, but this reminds me of a good book. It came out in France originally, but got translated into English. It was called Demotivational Training. And the first chapter was called Why Do Something Instead of Nothing. And the whole thesis of it is to say your energy is what runs this machine. And it was really advocating for people to drop out and to evade. But one of the fun metaphors that it talked about, even though it's not always the best metaphor, but it was ultimately saying that the industrial system operates on creating they use the donkey in the book, which was the classical. They use the coercion, the stick, you know, hit the donkey. They use the carrot in front of them. But most importantly, and sometimes we forget, the blinders on the donkey to make sure that he can't see any other possibilities. And the thing is that the industrial system, like dependency theory has showed us, operates in instituting dependency, not only on a kind of geopolitical level, but in our daily lives to create dependency that we need these things. We are it. You are the machine. You are a part of it. And so it wants to create this. And then to really just solidify it, is the addiction that you want it, you need it. And then on top of that, that there's blinders and you don't see any other possibilities or ways out to do these things. And I think there's a good graffiti on the wall in Berlin that said, we're all junkies and prostitutes, to really talk about how we're kind of placing these different roles of being, you know, selling ourselves in some capacity of, you know, obviously the term prostitute refers to sex work and things like this, but prostitution can take many different shades in terms of how you're selling yourself. But on the other side is that you're always a junkie for something, looking for a fix, some type of excitement, obviously traditionally associated with heroin addicts. But it, again, in terms of trying to get more of a fix, and this is about the relation in which you live life and how you live. And these kind of deeper conversations or personal are the really big challenges that we need to face. And there's not a more hypocritical kind of delusional kind of work than the critical academics who are tied with these universities and some of the things that we're doing. And it's to really try to make the best and use these spaces the best we can, but how can there be a healthier practice to like live life not only in our own personal lives, where we're not kind of killing ourselves through hyper work to spread a message or to survive within this kind of racket, but to also make it so our departments and our and kind of our universities are actually creating positive social change with, you know, real ecological, you know, real kind of qualities of social relationships improving, real qualities of food and kind of water and the things that really matter.
Yeah. Thank you so much for this. It's so fascinating, but I know that we're getting a bit short on time here. Like, we could keep going for ages and ages and ages. And I mean, hopefully you can come back on in the future, but it's getting to be that time in the program.
What's that time?
Question time.
Question time.
Question time.
Oh, it's question time. Ooh.
So in every episode, we like to cap things off with asking our guests, what can our listeners at home do? Like a call to action. If somebody's captured by this, they're interested, they want to make a difference, like a real on the ground physical difference. What can they do? I mean, it could be reading something. It could be joining a group. It could be just anything that you think that could let people get out there and make a difference in this.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the short answer is just follow your heart, you know, look around with what's really going on around you. Look what it is. Kind of get in touch with yourself and the things that you care about and recognize what the problems are and to move from there. And there's plenty of books you can read about, but I think really it's about really looking in yourself to identify what are the things you care about and what you see as being serious problems to your life and how to live. And I mean, this can obviously be interpreted in different ways, but I hope this is in terms of actually caring for the people around you and also the animals and the water and ultimately the environment that you live in that's going to give you and provide you food. And this obviously is difficult when you live in cities and you may have never even seen chickens or different kind of wild, so-called wild animals, but it's, I know, I guess wild animals, I think that one's safe to say, but it's, yeah, I think it really, and there's plenty of ways, but I think it's really about knowing yourself and knowing what that kind of what you feel and then figuring out what your politics are from there and moving on how you want to take action. You know, I'd hate to tell people to join something or to do anything because a lot of it's very complicated. The politics of resistance and actually how to undermine different kind of powers and infrastructures is extremely difficult. So I'd say follow your heart, learn who you are. This might mean engaging in different kind of many different kind of practices in your own kind of personal life. And there's many different kind of theories and ideas of resistance. And there's different groups of peoples and ideas who have definitely been more grounded and dedicated their time and life to actually figuring out how to fight this thing. But there's many open debates that aren't being had in academia, nor are they even acknowledged for maybe obvious reasons and then reasons of just sheer mistake. But I'll leave it at that. I'll be slightly cryptic.
That's a fabulous place to leave it. And I think a really good take-home message that we do need to, you know, be paying attention to what is right for us. And hopefully that translates if we're looking at our immediate local environment and interacting with that in a way that is, dare I say, sustainable. Oh God, the vocabulary limits us so much. Is there anything that you would like us to link down in the show notes for our listeners to find you further?
Oh yeah. I mean, they can see the Dramble on Twitter. I've got lots of books. There's tons of articles about a lot of the issues that I face or the kind of the horrible stuff that I uncover or I acknowledge. And also the many different kind of people and groups that are kind of in resistance and doing everything they can to fight these things. And there's a lot of different things of my own and yeah, I don't know.
So where do they find you for that Twitter ramble?
It's at @Dr.X_A. Dunlap. And, you know, I'm at the Center for Development and the Environment. I'm a postdoctoral research fellow over there. There's a profile, tons of links. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff coming out about the, you know, asking what does renewable energy exist? There's stuff about anarchist decolonization as opposed to decolonizing anarchism in terms of asking how anarchist tools and ideas can be useful for decolonization. And there's hopefully more stuff on infrastructural colonization by looking at the new wind park in Oaxaca with run by EDF and Union Hidalgo. But some of these things are under review still, but there's a lot coming, and hopefully it can be useful and guide people in their studies and in their struggles in their life and kind of what speaks to them.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So you heard it, folks. Look down in the show notes for a link to that profile and to find him on the Twitter Ramble. And hopefully, if you've enjoyed what you've heard here today, you'll be able to further engage with some of the work that Alexander has done. I've read some of it myself, and it's quite approachable and interesting. So I highly recommend, if you're interested in these topics, to give it a look.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute blast to get to talk about all these different things with you. As I said, you know, maybe sometime in the future again. But I mean, I know you got your busy schedule and everything, but if you ever want to come back and sit down and talk with us some more, we'd be happy to have you.
All right. No, sounds great. Thanks so much for having me. And of course, I'd love to. This has been a great, I've enjoyed my conversation with y'all. It's very nice to be able to talk about these different things and get it out there. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you again to Alexander Dunlap for coming on and having a great conversation with us. Please join us next month for a very powerful conversation with Yaffa Al-Masri about what life is like for stateless people and how refugees can save the world. From the snowy, ski-tracked forests of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sofia Hagelani-Albov, thanks for listening, stay safe, and we'll catch you next time.